Thanks, everyone, for coming. You're here for the many drafts of writers' lives put on by the class of 1989. And today we are fortunate to have three fabulous writers to share their stories with us. Next to me is Julie Burwall. She is a marine biologist. Okay.
She's Dr. Burwall.
Dr. Burwall. She has spent time working at Woods Hole, received her PhD at the University of Southern California, done work on the mathematical model to calculate rates of photosynthesis, and somehow parlayed that into the adventure of becoming an author studying jellyfish, is planning a project titled Spineless about the lives of jellyfish, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. Then we have Margie Stoll, the author of the five-book series, Beautiful Creatures. Is that right? Five books? And there's also Icons. She received her master's in writing from Stanford and also did coursework at Yale in American Studies. And her books have been, the first book has been turned into a movie, which was very popular, and starred Jeremy Irons, and I'm looking forward to hearing about that as well. Then Ms. Debbie Applegate. She has won the Pulitzer Prize for her biography of Henry Ward Beecher, whose statue you can see up by the Octagon. And she is now
Debbie's statue is up by the Octagon?
No, no.
Right Henry next Ward to Beecher. Henry.
I'm very portly and green. That's
way to go.
And she's now working on a work on Polly Adler, who is a notorious madam. So we should have lots of fascinating stories from our panelists. But I thought I'd start us off by having them say a little bit about how they evolved from graduating seniors at Amherst back in 1989 into writers. So I don't know who wants to start us off.
I think it goes that way.
Okay.
We'll start with the one who's not the writer. So I went to Amherst and Margie was my roommate. And she was the best writer I had ever met in my life. So that was one thing. And the next thing that happened was I turned in my very first essay in ILS, the brain, and it came back with red across the top, and it said, please see the writing counselor, Susan Snively.
Oh, yeah, remember Susan?
Susan Snively. And I was horrified because I'd never gotten anything negative in my life on anything academic before. I didn't go to see the writing counselor, and instead I started taking all math and science classes so I didn't have to write anything for the rest of my time at Amherst.
And you thought you were done with writing.
And I thought I was done forever.
As opposed to, I had never set foot in this building.
That's why we were late in starting. People were looking for the room.
The writers couldn't find the science building. And I never did write again until after my postdoc, I was miserable as a researcher, and I got a job at a textbook company, and they gave me like 100 words to explain all of photosynthesis, and so I had to learn how to write in order to do that, and I found out that writing was this incredible problem-solving tool that I never realized, and it helped me understand things in a way that like equations had before, and I just have gotten more and more fascinated with it, and then gotten even more interested in how you connect things that seem complicated to people who don't usually read those things, and so that's where I am today.
She's also written a lot for National Geographic. She's written a lot for textbooks in the science textbooks in the state of Texas. Think about that.
Oh yeah.
Someone has to keep them straight.
So she's the lone blue island in the textbook community.
I'm not alone. There's a lot of good people fighting the fight.
I'm Margie Stoll, and for my journey, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and mostly because, as one teacher said to me, I will pass you in this Algebra 2 class, but only if you swear to never take another math class again. Because you are not equipped to continue on. So I got into Amherst because because I had a teacher write a letter of recommendation to me. I probably told at least five of you this story. I got into Amherst because I had a teacher, my beloved English teacher, wrote a letter that said, this is literally the worst math student I have ever encountered in my life, but she is the most well-read student I've had, and these are her favorite books, and you should take a chance on her. And you do know this, my dad went to work that day, and in the Wall Street Journal, they were profiling Amherst acceptances that year, and they said, usually teacher recommendations are not helpful. One teacher's paused to say her student was the worst math student she'd ever had in her life, but, you know, went on to list her favorite books, which were all my favorite books, and it said on the break, they tossed the application into the accept pile, and the head of admission paused to write the teacher a thank you note, the only one of its kind that would be sent that year. And we had just gotten the thank you note. She said, ooh, I wonder what this means. And so my dad called me at 6 in the morning with the Wall Street Journal and said, you got into college. So I think my legacy, and when I graduated, Peter Pouncey, who was still there at the time, said, oh, you were that one who was really bad at math. So I think I came to Amherst and took 36 English classes. I took Buddhism classes with a couple of you guys, I think twice, with Buddha Bob, who I later wrote about in Beautiful Creatures, and the one glass-eyed teacher. And I took two Dutch and Flemish art classes, and I think that was it. All the rest were English literature classes.
Okay, so let me just say Dutch and Flemish art was really a literature class.
Okay. Yeah. It was right, with Joel
Upton. Because
she
dragged me to it, and I came out with a C. Yeah.
Joel Upton, right? Yes, and I had an absolutely uplifting experience with Karen Sanchez Epler, who was, and Barry O'Connell, and William Pritchard, who was my first B in a writing class. And those were the minds who shaped my life. Barry O'Connell had me write a journal in his, I guess his 19th century American Lit seminar, and you had to write a journal of the reading, and it was, my introduction to Emerson, or, the greats of the American Renaissance. And I remember the class was over, and I just kept writing the journal. And I think I gave him the rest of the journal, like, a year later. He was like, you're a crazy person. But those are the voices in my head, and I went on to see Debbie at Yale a bit later, and I was at Stanford, and what I studied after that were just stories. I just collected stories from then on, and I think that was sort of a kind of a narrative love I took forward. I got waylaid into animation screenplays and then video games for 16 years. We had a company, and then finally I was 40 years old and said none of this was what I wanted to do, and I kind of got back into that, but really, I think all the stories and the voices in my head began here. Debbie?
It must have been a trend that year in the admissions department, because I was in the bottom 20th percentile of math also. But when I, 490, I believe was the number, when I left Amherst and took the GREs, I had a 420.
Do you remember that paralyzing moment when you realized you had to do that again?
Oh, yeah, I just filled in little, so it's not a question. And the same thing, and figured, okay, well, let's just, and I too had the first paper, it was called New England, which was all I wanted. I was from Clackamas, Oregon. All I wanted was to be where the old stuff was and where people thought books were cool. And so I got here, I'm taking New England, and I got a C+, my very first paper, nice. Frank Cavares. I took the other attack, which was like, well, it's obvious science isn't going to work for me. I better learn to get better at this. But I would never, unlike you guys, I would never ever be a writer. I had no desire to be a writer. I was a reader. I thought writers were magic. I literally thought they did some weird sleight of hand, which it turns out they do, but it's tricks you can learn, it turns out. Yeah. But I had no desire to do it because I was clearly not magic. If somebody had paid me to read, I just would have kept doing that. And really, the real thing is they will not let you sit all day long. Well, somebody would, but I could not eat then.
I actually did work as a reader. For a year and a half.
Did you like it?
Yeah, no. It was Hollywood. It was so I live in LA now where people don't actually, they only option books. Someone else reads them. So I was the person who read them before the buying happened.
And to me, and so we actually tracked, well, in fact, as the people clearly never took any, the least balanced curriculum in the entire history of the school, we reconnected, Margie and I, at the American Studies program at the same time at Yale. And I remember, I have two quotes. I remember one of them. Actually, I may be misremembering. It was probably Bill Pritchard. Bill Pritchard, freshman year, saying to me, "Oh yes, your class 1989. You guys are a good class." He says, "Are you the one who's read everything that Jane Austen has written?" And I was like, "Oh no, that's Margie." and then I might have encountered that again at Yale with Alan Trachtenberg. Really, were you always trotting that out?
I had one story, Debbie. I had to tell it for what it was worth.
But the last thing I would say is I have not probably evolved at all. My first book was based on the paper I wrote in a sophomore seminar that then became my senior thesis that then about the portly green guy by the Octagon that then became my dissertation and that then became my first book. So basically I live very much like I did at college. In fact, when I was here last year we came up to see the 88 reunion, I was really behind, and I'm finishing a book, and I was really behind, and I had not turned in my chapter, and it sucked being at reunion. Everyone else was done with the semester, and I still hadn't finished my finals. I gained 7 pounds at the class of 88 reunion, eating out of frustration, drinking and not getting drunk. This year, I just turned in a chapter yesterday, already heard back from my editor, so I will be drinking and getting drunk, and I will not be eating nearly as much here. I'll turn it back to you.
Well, that's a perfect segue into a question that I want to ask. Many of us, I think, imagine that maybe someday there could be a book or an essay or a play somewhere in us, and you were talking about how your book about Henry Ward Beecher evolved. But your book about Polly Adler, The Beautiful Creatures, The Spineless, how do you know when something is going to have that kind of momentum that it can actually sustain itself into a book? How do you know when you've arrived upon something that's worth pursuing at that level of depth?
Well, all brains are really different. That's one thing I've learned. I have a writing partner on one series, and I write a series alone and some other books alone. And working that closely with someone has taught me just how different brains are. So I don't think anyone can know. I think we all arrive at what's viable for a book separately. I think we throw a lot more away than people realize. And I think, my closest friend, who I actually wrote a play about when I was here at Amherst, he writes middle grade fiction under the name Pseudonymous Bosch. But I wrote a play here starring Tim Bone as him. And I cast a girl as me who had awesome cheekbones, because that was my goal. She was from Hampshire College. But he writes 3 sentences a day. That's what he writes. He poops out 3 perfect sentences a day. I write 100 exploratory pages to see if I want to do something. And then many of those get chucked and are under my bed. I have boxes of, this might happen, this will never happen, this should never have happened. And I think, so for me, I fumble around and I feel my way around the edges because I'm an adrenaline drafter, because that's the way my brain goes, in a sort of manic, let's spit it out and see what's there. And he forms ideas perfectly cohesively over, a year of stress in the shower, and then just moves methodically through it till it's done. So who can you, what can you say? It's all totally different.
How do you guys work?
Do you poop or do you shower? What's the...
Whenever I do it very, very slowly.
Yeah. You're more of the perfect poop.
I'm going to say a long and slow and not always fun one. How about that one? That I don't know because I'm the exact opposite. I have one book. I will have two. If I live long enough, I will have three. And I have that's all I have in me. I'm almost positive. They're going to be my American Studies trilogy. I only am doing things that people already have written too much about. The American transcendental, you know, Renaissance, 1920s jazz age. I figure I got a baby boomer book in me and that's it. But to me, I was never going to write another book again after the first one, ever. It was just at the end. It was just every day pushing until like 11 o'clock at night because I'm not an adrenaline writer, and I felt that black cloud. When I finished, I actually felt like a 19th century schoolboy who had studied too long by candlelight and had, you know, my vision was going and I was having
My vision always goes at the end.
Right.
Exactly. You spend too long on and you go blurry.
It could have just been psychosomatic. But really what happened was, I don't have children, but I'm pretty sure that there not one of you would have more than one child if there weren't some kind of labor amnesia. And I just forgot after a little while. And people were saying, hey, why don't you write another book? That worked out. And so I thought, well, where would I go? If I had to take a time machine, because that's, to me, the only thing that's interesting about being a historian is the idea of immersing yourself in some places, which is why I loved Amherst, because it was so easy to like squint and pretend it was the olden days. So I thought, where would I take a time machine if I have to go on this miserable trip again? And I thought, why not 1920s New York? And literally, it was just a book. I was going through open stacks at the Yale Library, and it had a red cover, and it was a memoir of this madam, this very famous brothel keeper from the Jazz Age. And you could just, to me, same thing with Beecher, you could just see they have legs as a subject. They have complexity, they have personal interest, they have drama, and that they could, literally when I wrote that sophomore seminar paper, I was like, I bet I could run with this. I just didn't realize how far and how few ideas other than that I would have.
Yeah, when did you know that jellyfish were?
Right, so, I think for me it's a kind of a geeking out thing, because I was working on a National Geographic story on ocean acidification, and they asked me to fact check this question about what creatures were going to do well in the future acidified ocean, and they had jellyfish on the winner's side, and it just kind of struck me as...
Winners?
And right. And so I started digging in the literature, and I found that, you know, not only are they winners because of acidification, but winners because of all these other things we're doing to this planet. So suddenly jellyfish became like this really interesting way to talk about really relevant problems.
Jellyfish had legs.
Jellyfish had legs. And it was the kind of thing where it's a very different kind of writing than fiction or even, you know, going back into being in a time machine, but I found that every door I looked in had like way more rooms that would open up as I started to dig into the scientific literature. And then even Margie actually came to Austin pretty soon after I started, where I was able to say the words, I'm writing a book. And without, and I still was, whenever I would say the words, I'm writing a book, I would go, hee hee. Margie goes, get rid of that laugh. But she also said, you know, just write it. Don't get caught up in whether it's what it is. Just write it. Just even if it's the worst thing you can write, write. And that was actually incredible advice.
Thank you. Well, it's a different thing learning how to finish something than it is learning. We terrify ourselves into paralysis, and so forcing yourself through paralysis to a generative place is a big step. So I always, when I'm teaching writing classes, I say, please set out to write the very worst book in the history of the world. Please let that be your goal, because you will stumble onto something that may be the beginning of where you're supposed to be. But if you don't learn the shape of a project, if you don't learn how to get through it, you will never do anything. So that's the fear, is the, like, you got to shut down that inner hater.
Yes.
there was a few a month or so ago going across the internet, Facebook-y type of stuff, which I do not do on principle, although I have a lot of friend requests from some of you people in this room. Sorry about that. That I noticed every writer I knew procrastinating reading this article in the Atlantic Monthly on procrastination, and the theory was that writers procrastinate only until the point at which their fear of doing a crappy job on the page is overcome by their fear of not turning something in and missing a deadline. And to me, what you do, well, you guys both do it so well, but journalists, it seems like you have a different metabolism. Like, I would kill myself if I had to turn, it would be better for me, but if I had to turn something in on a regular journalistic basis, I would have to be rewired.
But there's a length thing going on. You know, I mean, you're not writing a book when you turn in a piece. There's a shorter... But I think, you know, I actually got asked to write a book once, and then I got pulled off of it, and it was for a photographer who was doing this amazing project where he was taking and documenting all the organisms in a cubic foot of different ecosystems around the world.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so they asked me to write all the text for this book, and the person who asked me, the editor, said, oh, it's just like, you just write little articles and then put them together and it's a book. But it's not a book. Because for all the reasons you guys know. And so I think that, you know, this idea of an arc and finishing it is really fundamental to writing books, as I'm learning now.
So thinking of this generative process, sometimes the writing may take you to a place that you didn't anticipate you would go. Does anyone have an interesting tale of an adventure that arose out of a writing project that was unanticipated but memorable that you can share?
I had to hire a marshal out in California to get the papers of this madam held by a long lost cousin whose ex-boyfriend had a restraining order because he had threatened to kill her. And I thought that was about as good as I get, because mostly I sit with dead people in an archive day after day. I had to go out there but for the most part, no, actually I have no adventures with live people.
That was pretty exciting. There was an episode like that on Castle last week. So I'm pretty impressed with your life now. We'll have to talk after. For me, the exciting stuff is this is a fan book that one of Stacy's students made, and I've gotten these in France, and I've gotten these in different countries, and it's the way your readers react all over the world, and I think that's a particular thing about working with teenagers. It's so fabulous, but... The Beautiful Creatures series in particular is in 50 countries, and my kids, the other part of my life is that I love to travel. Starting with junior year abroad here, I was in a writing program in Norwich where I saw some of these clowns in between, and traveled around in the days when people bought Eurail passes and just sort of went around the world, and then fell asleep on the train and ended up in, you know, I think formerly what was Yugoslavia, because we couldn't afford a hotel and woke up in the wrong country. But and I've never gotten over that. My kids are fencers, and they would go around the world fencing, and that was the other sort of wanderlust. So I take every opportunity to meet readers around the world. So I've had fabulous experiences with people who have read the books who are in Kuala Lumpur about to go off to an arranged marriage in a country they don't know which one. I have talked to people who had just served in the army in their country. I have talked to really, really depressed kids around the world because of standardized testing, which I would say ruins the lives of children in every country, whether it's the BAC or the O-level or the SAT and every possible test in Asia. I've met with Chinese readers in Taipei, where I was with Uni. I just got back this year from doing book events in the Czech Republic, in Prague and in Budapest, and seeing different readers react differently to not just stuff you've written, but like whole genres and books you've shared, and talking to people about dystopias that are so popular for teenagers here, like Divergent was of my another friend I work with worked on, or like The Hunger Games. Then you speak to someone in Budapest or in Prague who says we don't like dystopias. We already lived them, right? We can remember them. Our grandfather being tortured in this city. Do you want to see where it happened? And it's so interesting, the sort of global reach of what a book can take you to and how people will tie to it differently. So I think that's been the unexpected journey. I thought I would just be working in my room writing a book. That was kind of my plan. And all the sort of, yep. the breadth of that has been the crazy part.
Please.
Well, yeah, I've chased the jellyfish around the world.
on a boat with crazy scientists in Japan.
Fishermen, yeah. Yeah, I've gone jellyfishing in Japan, and I was like almost in Korea, and we were chasing this jellyfish that grows to 500 pounds. And I've had pretty good adventures.
As one does.
We got two, but they were puny, like around 300 pounds. So,
oh my God.
I know, puny. And, but yeah, I mean, I think because I came at this as an ocean scientist, so I'd been on research vessels and in grad school and afterwards, it felt really normal to me to go try to get outside of my house and be close to my subject.
Grab it.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a I'm kind of pretending like I'm a journalist, so I feel like that's what journalists should do. They should go have interaction with whatever they're trying to write about. So yeah, I've had cool.
Stacey, I have a question.
Yeah.
So when Alan Trachtenberg, the advisor I was talking about at Yale, had his son went to Amherst, and he almost taught here. And one of the things he said, went, I think probably after the whole damn Jane Austen thing again, we went to college together. He said, oh, yeah, Amherst. You went to Amherst. You know, kids from Amherst, people from Amherst, graduate students, they got a lot of graduate students from Amherst. He said, really understand genre. It was kind of amusing. And then he went on, but really understand genre. And I really thought, that was I've thought about that a lot since then, and so I would be very curious to see if that is if you think that's true, if there's something about the Amherst experience that makes you think about the rules and breaking the rules, but the rules and the structures of genre and literature generally.
I don't know. I think that's really interesting. I definitely think we had a really advanced. I mean, I came to Amherst for two reasons. One, because they accepted me. I think we've established that was a reach. And two, because Emily Dickinson's house was on campus. So that was like a specific... I mean, it wasn't a broad calculus. But they had the best English department in the country, and I came to go to that. And at the time, it was the era of Bill Pritchard and the people who knew Robert Frost.
I think it's still his era.
It's still his era. But it was, I mean, these were like the whole, I think the advent of Karen Sanchez Epler and the advent of American Studies here and Rhonda. And just really sort of, and I think just sort of the concept of we started really reading, and we were in the time of sort of new historicism, and when people started really contextualizing the sort of cultural production of genre, and I think that was something, I mean, they were obviously doing it at a lot of other schools, but I became really aware of, the Penny Press and the production of children's, literature.
When you made your decision, you moved from being an academic to being writing for computer games because you saw that as an up-and-coming medium, but then you moved into another equally...
I moved out of academics after Stanford and Yale because, as Bill Pritchard once wrote on my paper, blah, 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 once again, you have a tendency to become unmoored. No truer words were ever spoken. So I was not good enough at teaching to be a professor.
I'm not a professor.
But I think you can see even from a conversation, I have, you know, we're not going to say adult ADD, but it's close. And I definitely, the way my brain works sort of circles and feels its way around something over and over and over. It's not a straight line. So for me, academics, I loved everyone at Stanford. I was like, you know, you can all have an extension. No worries. It's all great. Come to my house. We can talk about it. No problem. You know, you can all have an A minus. It's all good. Like, I wasn't cut out for the instruction of the young fine mind, right, is really what happened. Right. And I was from LA, so I started working, sort of creating content. But I think for me, I always just loved genre reading. I love fantasy. I am still sitting in the closet waiting for Aslan to come, you know. Mm-hmm. I wanted a Surrey with, you know, I wanted a lawn dress. I wanted I wanted to play with Laura Ingalls Wilder and throw the pig's bladder, you know, for the ball and make the maple candy. And I wanted all the magic stuff. So for me, that was kind of what I read, I think, more than what I studied here. You didn't study journalism here, really.
No, not at all. But I just want to say, like, even though I did do everything on this side of campus only, I always was a huge reader, and I always read fiction more than anything. And so even now that I read a lot of nonfiction, I always miss the magic in the nonfiction. I mean, I think that there's something that goes on in your brain when you read fiction that makes you just leave your own, you know, place in the world, and that is... That's something that science, I think, would communicate a lot better if it can manage to do that.
Well, this is one of the interesting things, by the way, that Julie does that I think is fascinating. Is like one of her jobs has been the UT hiring her to try to translate, to try to get very, very, you know, scientists with very specific knowledge to be able to communicate to humanity. And I find that so fascinating because we have such an increasingly specialized world, and the people who are the specialists who know the answers have an increasingly hard time explaining the answers to the masses. And so I think that's one of my favorite stories. You have all these amazing stories, but one of the stories I love is you trying to get the scientists to say something a person could understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think Amherst is like a great example of that, because I don't know, I felt very much like I was learning I was on this other side of the campus from the humanities, and that was a mistake. I think about
it. So you should take a well-rounded curriculum, is what you're saying?
I should have. Yeah.
No, we should have.
I mean, maybe we had too much freedom that. You know, I mean, so many people came here because there were no requirements.
Well,
we all do, you know. But it's a question. I think it's a good question. It's worth thinking about.
Are there any questions from the audience? We have these three writers up here, and I think it's a great opportunity. If anybody has anything they'd like to ask, go ahead.
But writing is not editing, and writing for scientists is not writing, is fantasy, is not writing history. The technical skills and the personality seem to be a match to be the writer that you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wait, Jade, can I just add, doesn't she also have an MFA?
She does have an MFA, creative writing from Emerson.
Say yes.
Look, I think one of the things we all learned here, we learned how to think critically because we learned how to read critically. So for an English major or whatever it was, I think a humanities education, you learn how to think. I took 1 year off from Amherst. I went to UCLA, and I took 4 senior seminars in English literature because I could, because I was only there for a quarter before I went to this other writing program in England. And I talked
I talked all the time. I was that annoying kid who talked all the time in your seminar of 10 people. And after one of the classes, and everyone else is a senior, I was a pipsqueak. They came up to me and said, "Aren't you scared?" And I was like, "Why would I be scared? It's just school." And they were like, "You talk and talk." And it's like, that's a professor right there. And you're talking to a professor. And I thought, man, you guys are weird. But I had no concept of the 500-person lecture hall or the, you know what I mean? Or even my daughter, I have a daughter at Stanford, a daughter at Columbia, and my daughter, you know, took organic chemistry in a room at Columbia with hundreds and hundreds of people. And I just never had had any of those experiences. And I also grew up after Amherst thinking that what I had to say mattered, and that my opinion was relevant, and that people wanted to know what I thought. So it never occurred to me that Barry O'Connell didn't want to read a year of my journal entries about the American Renaissance, which he, by the way, dutifully like returned to me with loving notes written all the way through. Wow. But it did not ever cross my mind that that was an inappropriate response to material a year later. So I think that was the big gift, that whatever you ended up doing or however you ended up using it, we were all fools when we were here. We all did foolish, foolish things. But whatever happened planted some seed that turned us into people who valued ourselves, or I feel that way years down the road. Yeah.
The courage, personality part of being able to produce a large creative work.
Yeah.
I always found, I thought, not every place has this weird thing about writing senior theses also. Yeah, it's really weird how many people write senior theses at Amherst compared to other places. And I think even people who didn't write a thesis thought about it, thought maybe I should embark on a year-long writing project of this. Not everyone, J.H., I know. But I believe Bruce was just reminding that people used to say rite is ote. It was quite commonly said, actually, among certain people. But the idea that we might all contemplate, even if to reject it, the idea that we were going to have a long, 50 to 70 to 200 page writing project.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but you're right. And I actually, because I was a math major, but I got really interested in biology my junior year and I couldn't switch my major. So I did rite because my senior project, which I made up for myself, was in biology, which wasn't my major. But yeah, I mean, you get swept up in this idea of I can do this long thing and really dig in. And I think that is a gift that we...
And I felt finishing it, it was very important to me to do, to prove to myself that that I wasn't a gadfly, that I wasn't somebody who couldn't do math, just that. I am somebody who can't do math, but not just that.
No, and you think how seriously we took those. I mean, I dedicated mine to the baby of my professor.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was like, this is the biggest gift you can give someone. These 100 pages are gold. This is history I'm making here. And it was the first editorial relationship I had.
Right?
Right. That was your first editor.
I also remember that I had a job, a summer job, the summer before senior year in the Amherst College Archives. Great job. Very good air conditioning. It's very muggy here in the summer. You never know that if you don't stay. One of the things I was doing was moving the senior theses, the ancient decades, hundreds of years of senior theses, and putting them somewhere else. And I think maybe we were, I don't know. Anyway, and there was clearly very low supervision. And so I was reading, you know, I was going through it because I was thinking, okay, what am I going to do for the senior thesis? I read David Foster Wallace's entire senior thesis sitting there like...
Weren't there two?
I did not read the philosophy one. I read the novel. I read the novel. And then the year, the next summer, must have been summer before junior, that I read his first novel came out, The Broom of the System, great book, and it was word, not word for word, but very close. The first half of the book, first third of the book, was very close to his senior thesis. And I didn't think at the time, well, first of all, no one knew who David Foster Wallace right. then. It wasn't like, oh, but I remember it vividly. I read them both, and I remember thinking, not explicitly like, hey, if he could do that, I could do that. Yeah. But it made it so that I never really questioned it along the way, whereas it's ridiculous the way things went. I mean, nothing but serendipity and good luck and being blind, but I do think Amherst really can give you the confidence to go around blindly doing things.
Yeah.
let's go right here.
Debbie, you mentioned that you use their tricks that you use. What are the tricks that you guys use to eke out the really good ideas?
I'm a big believer in anthropomorphizing, that people like to have things be told as if they were through human eyes, through human point of view, and we are totally suckers for that. I mean, why would we ever root for Tony Soprano, except that we spend a lot of time seeing the world through his point of view? And it turns out I had to really teach myself this. I had to actually, because I never did take a real creative writing class, I had to go through and read how-to manuals, how to write thrillers, how to write genre fiction. I even read a really great article on how to write porn, because you want to give it a lot of vividness. And that the idea that then they're, how to create point of view, they're using very specific languages, through limiting what you can say, as like that took me a long time, but trying to, on the page, trying to make it as if visually you are seeing it through a character's eyes or through an implied character. That took a long time, but that to me is a sleight of hand. And yeah, that's my biggest trick that I remember.
Everyone works differently, so everyone has different tricks. I have a writing partner who reads a lot of writers have read Story by Robert McKee, or they've read, there's one about getting a cat out of a tree, and you know, the 1,000 faces of a hero, or you know, like a hero's journey and all that stuff. And I think that's great, and all of that stuff works differently for different people. I am deeply moved by a couple books about writing. I once wrote a paper about how Eudora Welty's One Writer's Beginning is really about being a daughter, and about how Eudora Welty's Optimist Daughter is really about being a writer. So sometimes I like the books where writers aren't really giving out the tips, but are writing about a writer's life, because that's the only way my brain can connect to it, probably because of whatever is wrong with my brain. But I really like, my favorite book on writing is called Bird by Bird. That's Annie Lamott. And, it's not really like strategic tips as much as it is like, these are her observations. In writing, as in hockey, if there's no puck on the rink, it's just a lot of guys skating around looking stupid. So that's her plot advice. You need to have a puck going somewhere across the ice. It's not going to go in a straight line, but if there's no puck, your guys are going to look pretty stupid. That's about the level of writing tip I can take in. The one thing I have learned is to notice things. And I notice everything. And I tell this to teenagers all the time, because teenagers spend the most time building character. Their shoes are so personalized. When I teach a teen writing class, I bring a photograph of my daughter's new red high-top Converse, and then I bring the actual pair of the red high-top Converse that she wore for 7 years that are like cut open with every band name and piece of signing and poetry and replaced shoelace and rip that is so incredibly personalized. And that is the way teens assemble themselves before they sort of go about their day. And I think that level of attention to the detail, the debris, and the sort of flotsam and jetsam of life, I think that's what really makes a book come to life. So I just say, carry a pen, carry a piece of paper, or write it on your hand, whatever it is, but that the difference between being a writer and not being a writer is about 30 seconds, because that's how long it takes it to float away forever in my head, which, as we've established, has a few problems. What's your jam, Jules?
I don't know. One thing, and I haven't studied writing nearly as long as you guys have, but one thing I've learned is that if you can write, the more active voice you can use, the more active, especially with science the world around you, if you know, if you can keep it really active, that keeps the energy, the puck moving.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing I do. And then there's another thing I've learned recently, which is from George Saunders, who I've been reading some of his stuff because it's super tight, and I think that that's a good thing for scientists to think about, is that you can write, he does this thing where he undercuts. You can write something really, really, really beautiful and then write kind of a joke after it, and it keeps it from getting sappy. And so I think with science, you can keep it from getting boring by putting some, you know, you can write a little bit that's pretty technical and then put something beautiful after it, or something in the moment, you know, where you're engrossed in something after this piece of technical writing. And that keeps the brain from tuning out, I think, as you read it. So those are sort of the things I've been thinking about lately.
Mm-hmm. So I think we'll take one more, and then maybe the writers have a few minutes.
Also, you have a poem, don't you?
Yeah, I wanted to hear
it. Well, this is because I'm supposed to be Matt Spreeder, who is a poet, and I'm not. So I thought...
She was recruited.
I'm a weak stand-in, but I thought, as homage to Matt, I should write a poem about jellyfish.
Brave.
Consider the life. So this is Amherst telling me I can do these things.
Right.
I can do anything. I can write
a poem.
You're
switching up the genres.
You're reading a poem in Merrill.
I know.
That you wrote.
Okay, and it has three different final lines because I couldn't figure out which one was the best.
We'll help you.
Okay. Well, my son Ben told me which one to read, but we can read all three and decide later. Okay. Consider the life of a jelly. It has just one hole to its belly. You might think it's crass, but it eats with its ass, and its tentacles are like vermicelli.
Oh, you win! You win, Matt. I'm calling you Julie Zapruder.
You got your poetry for the day.
Okay, last question.
I will say being a biographer is not really what you would call making a living. I did luck out. I mean, that's one of the other things about going to one of these schools is there are just a lot of people doing it. So when I was like, nope, I can't be a professor, too hard work, and kids aren't grateful. Then I thought, I just started asking around, do you know an agent? And you know, that's why you come to a place like this, because somebody did, and just by sheer luck, lots of failures in between that I had to pick myself up from, but that kind of networking really, I think, is the biggest part of it. As far as the actual money part, I honestly would have had to stay a professor, and just have that as a day job, and I would have written an academic book instead of a crossover book. For that, I suggest you have a partner, and I suggest you get one that enjoys making money, and that makes it so much easier. Yeah. And I also suggest you marry someone from your own class, because that's that also. I mean, class of '89. I don't mean.
So she's suggesting you marry Bruce, basically. Yeah,
he's out of your class.
He's back there. Give it a shot. I hear he's a good guy.
I have actually had a friend of mine, Lainey Taylor, who's a novelist, who was actually nominated for American Book Award, which makes her a National Book Award, which makes her a fancy novelist. When kids ask her advice about writing, she says, "Live somewhere cheap."
Yeah, that's awesome. Buy a duplex.
Which I say, Lainey, stop saying that. These people are 14 and live with their mom. She said, that's only cheap for a while. But definitely for me, I had a similar situation where the best friend who I wrote the play about at Amherst, in a very long story, he participated in a writing partner program for my then 10-year-old at
our school in Los Angeles. And my then, he was in a terrible slump and was going to stop being a writer. He had never had anything published. He had low-level jobs writing for cartoons. And they were supposed to exchange writing. My daughter said, I don't believe you have any writing. You're just sending me top 10 lists about why you hate writing and ways to procrastinate writing. And you just, like, you don't have anything, do you? And he said, oh, I have writing. I have something. It's just a secret. I can't tell you anything about it. It's far too dangerous. And it was so funny what he would send her that she would send him back letters wanting to know more about this book about which he could say nothing. So in the course of a correspondence with the child, which was literally the only thing that could get my depressive procrastination, I poop out three sentences a day friend out of bed, he wrote a book in letters to my child. And all the kids at the school started waiting for the letters to come because it was so funny. And I said to him, you realize you've got to finish this now. Oh, it was anonymous. And so he sold that book at the end of the school year based on the letters called The Name of This Book is Secret. And it became a best-selling series called The Secret Series. And he still writes under a pseudonym, Pseudonymous Bosch, based on his writing partner's pseudonym. I tell you that story because I only wrote a book when I was 40 with that same kid's teacher, her third grade teacher of all my children. And we wrote it on a dare from my oldest daughter because you will do things for obnoxious children that you will not do for yourself. My oldest daughter, I said, Mrs. Garcia and I came up with a great idea for a book. And she laughed in my face and said, yeah, Mom, you might say you're going to write a book, but you're not really. In 3 days, you're going to be doing something else because you never finish anything. And I said, oh, it's on. You are going down. And it took us 12 weeks. I had no idea how to write a book. It was the most terrifying thing that ever happened. She threw me off a cliff. Because, you know, they say that your memories are, like, crystallized by adrenaline, I can remember sitting down and just typing and my inner hater saying, you are such an idiot, that one word has already ruined this whole thing. But I said to myself, I didn't say I was going to write a good book. That wasn't the bet. I just said I would write a book. And that was it. It took 12 weeks, and then I had a book. And then the guy who my daughter had forced to get published, sent our book to his agent without even telling us, and we were published. So really, you don't have to just marry Bruce. You have to have my 10-year-old in your house.
You've got a whole family in the making.
You introduce your daughter to
Yeah. Yeah. She's also the one who I kept home from school for 3 days before he turned in the final project because she was so mean that she edited the material because we knew she wouldn't let anything cheesy past her. She would say, Mom, you don't have to say, and then it happened because, oh, hey, guess what? In the next sentence, then it happened. I was like, all right, you little. And then she'd say, Mrs. Garcia.
Oh, I could use her.
Yeah, she'd say, Mrs. Garcia. And this is her teacher she's talking to, Mrs. Garcia. You know, some people might say when you emphasize everything, it's pretty much the same thing as emphasizing nothing. You'd be like, all right. And then on the end of the third day, she said, Mom, I have to go to school. It's the law. And I said, what any mother would say, which is, get back in that room and write. It's for the family. So no one in my family has ever read any of my books ever again. But it worked once.
I'll just say my book is my most expensive hobby I could possibly have right now. And all my frequent flyer miles are gone.
Well, I really want to thank all of you for coming and all of you for coming to hear them talk about their books.